Hello, my name is Mark Gibson, and you're listening to the podcast version of the Chagask Signpost Series, a weekly webinar that promotes and examines sustainability in Irish farming.
Good morning, and you're very welcome to this morning's Signpost webinar. This morning, we're being joined by Dr. James Humphreys, Senior Researcher at Chagask Moor Park. James will be talking to us this morning about lowering the carbon and ammonia footprint of pasture-based dairy production systems as part of the LOCAM project. Also joined by Owen O'Brien. Owen is ASAP advisor in the Carlow, Wexford, Wicklow region to help us with the questions. Owen, you're very welcome. James, do you want to try and share your presentation if you're ready there?
The presentation today is this project. It's a Department of Agriculture funded project that we have, and it's looking at lowering the carbon and ammonia footprint of pasture-based dairy production. Now, Owen Cashin made a presentation on this last week, and I guess we all know the background to the issues, and it's you know, a large proportion of our greenhouse gases nationally come from agriculture, 38%. And there's a target as part of the climate action plan to lower emissions by 25% by 2030. And that's the background to this project. So if we ask ourselves the question, where do emissions come from? You can see a large proportion of the emissions from an intensive dairy farm come from the dairy herd, from ruminant digestion. We have more emissions also are associated with the management of slurry and manure, through the storage and application of and we get both nitrous oxide and emission and methane emissions. And then we also get emissions from the application of fertilizer in the form of nitrous oxide. And that's a major focus of the work that we've been doing. And the final 10% then it's emissions from the combustion, internal combustion engine, for example. If we talk about the electricity used to run the milking machine, the manufacture of fertilizer is very, very energy intensive, and that's the 10% coming from that source. So with that in mind, we set up this experiment here, which we've been running now for a long number of years, and looking at how we can reduce emissions relative to a control. And Owen gave a very detailed presentation on this last week, so I'm just going to summarize it here in terms of three different herds. The control system here getting a high nitrogen fertilizer input. There's no clover in those swards, or very little. We get very little nitrogen fixation. And as a consequence of that, we get fairly high emissions. We have this other system here, which is a clover-based system, getting nitrogen fertilizer in the spring in the form of urea or protected urea, mainly protected urea in recent times. Higher clover content in those swards, we're getting a fair amount of nitrogen fixation. And as Owen showed last week, there's lower emissions associated with that. There's no emissions associated with it. So the emissions here are coming from the fertilizer and from slurry. And that was working well for us. So we were looking into the possibility, was there any other areas where we could push down the emissions? And we decided to try a zero nitrogen approach. And we've been running this system now for 5 years. That's where there's very little or no fertilizer going in, much higher reliance on clover and nitrogen fixation. And because of that, our emissions are lower. And we look at our greenhouse gas emissions, we're talking 20-30% lower emissions and 40% lower ammonia emissions. And I suppose the key question then is, how does that impact on profitability? And as Owen showed last week, we were seeing no difference in the profitability of these three systems, or slightly improved profitability. It all depends on the price of nitrogen fertilizer. At least there's no difference. At best there's no difference, but with higher emissions or higher profitability when we have a high fertilizer price that we've tended to have there in recent years. So if we look at the productivity of these systems, I suppose the bottom line here is the important thing. This is over, you know, each 5 years for these systems, very little difference in harvest production. And that's what underpins the productivity and the profitability. And of course, Owen dealt with that last week. So what we're talking about this week is putting this research into context. What's the possibility for adoption on farms? And the question I often get is why are we looking at zero nitrogen fertilizer input? And of course, this became very topical in recent years with the huge spike in nitrogen fertilizer prices. We can see the trends here over the last 10 years or so. Fertilizer prices were rising during 2021 prior to the war in Ukraine. And then when the war kicked off, of course, we saw a massive spike. And even though we saw a reduction in fertilizer prices during 2023, they've come back down to similar levels to what they were just before the war started. And of course, this spike has more or less coincided with this project, and there's been huge interest in the work that we're doing. I think particularly the zero nitrogen system has attracted a lot of attention. And very large numbers of discussion groups pressing through Solihull since the lockdown ended in 2021. And we reckon that there was at least 5,000 farmers in discussion groups who passed through the farm. And huge interest in the work. And driven, of course, by the price of nitrogen fertilizer. And when we look at the fertilizer use nationally, we can see that that spike has had a big impact in fertilizer use in recent years. We see a rising trend here during the 2010s with, with the expansion of dairy production was the primary driver of that. It kind of peaked then during between 2018 and 2021. And 2018 is the baseline that we're using for reduction targets in terms of fertilizer use and in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And then if we look at the reductions, we saw a 14% reduction in between 21 and 22. And then an even bigger reduction between 22 and 23, which is a bit surprising when you take into account the drop in fertilizer prices and assuming, well, clearly fertilizer use is very price sensitive, but I guess a lot of that fertilizer was bought early in the year when it was still relatively expensive. EPA produced these images here, which give a very clear picture. And if we look at the impact here of the reduction in fertilizer use and associated reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, you can see there's a 1.2% reduction in national emissions going from 21 to 22, even though there was an increase in dairy cow numbers. And it shows the impact that fertilizer use can have on greenhouse gas emissions. So this shows, again, fertilizer use, national fertilizer use, and the red line here is the national greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. The baseline is, as I said, is 2018, and the EU Commission wasn't very happy with our performance over the first 4 years up to 2021 in a recent report. But since then, we've seen a reduction. And of course, these 23 figures here are provisional, but we are seeing a downward trend driven partly by fertilizer, but also by other things. And you might say that these emissions reductions are relatively modest, but they are reductions. And I guess we have to start somewhere. And there is a close enough relationship there between fertilizer use and national greenhouse gas emissions. This shows the contribution of fertilizer nitrogen to emissions. The blue part of the bars here is the contribution of fertilizer nitrogen. And you can see between 2018 and 21, it accounts for around 10%. And as fertilizer use has come down, that's accounting for a smaller percentage, going down to 10% there last year. Or 7% last year. And I guess the question then is, even if we cut out nitrogen fertilizer altogether, that will still only get us down around 10%. So for every 10% reduction in fertilizer use nationally, we'll see a 1% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And we've seen that over the last 2 years where emissions have gone down by 30%. Where does that put us then in terms of the reduction target, which is the red line here? We still see that there's a considerable reduction to be achieved. And the question then is, where will these emission reductions come from? Because if we're faced with choices as an industry, you could talk about, say, restricting the size of national dairy herd. You could talk about cutting suckler cow numbers. And these things have been actively debated. Cutting fertilizer nitrogen seems to me to be the low-hanging fruit, particularly if we can replicate the type of production that we've seen in Solihull. So in terms of, say, having a look at that question, a hypothetical question, if we were to implement our work towards zero nitrogen fertilizer use on grassland farms in Ireland, like we've seen in Solihull, that we can maintain profitability or get higher profitability, depending very much on the price of fertilizer. It would lower national emissions by 10%. Greenhouse gas emissions would lower ammonia emissions by 24%. Could achieve the same level of national output and export value. And it would have a positive impact on the balance of payments. And I think it'll also be very positive from the point of view of the product image and unique selling proposition. If we were producing products without use of nitrogen fertilizer, and all of the problems that are associated with it in terms of nitrate leaching, and greenhouse gas and ammonia emissions. So if we look at the balance of payments then for 2022, we can see that food exports are up at 18.8 billion, which is increasing massively over the last few years. And I guess that's partly driven by inflation. But that includes all exports, including fishery and forestry products. If we break that down purely on the basis of grassland-based products, milk, beef, and sheep products, it's around 10.5 billion, which again is increasing rapidly. And relative to that, then we have the import, the cost of importing fertilizer, which was just over $1 billion last year. And I suppose that emphasizes the huge industry that represents. If we put that relative, say, powders, cheese, and butter exports, for example, like we're still talking about a substantial proportion in terms of balance of payments. In terms of the image, then, clover is associated with Ireland. It's a national emblem. It's already well established, and I guess over the next over the current week with Cheltenham and the rugby match on Saturday and St. Patrick's Day on Sunday, we'll be overloaded with this imagery over the next few days. So if we take, I think there is a marketing prospect there. And then if we look at the situation out on farms and say, well, how could this work? This shows fertilizer use over the last 10 years on dairy farms, according to the National Farm Survey. And I've used the last 10 years because we have seen reduction in recent times, but it's not as variable as you might think. Peak there coinciding with peak emissions in 2008, or peak fertilizer use nationally in 2018, and it has declined since then. And then if we look at beef farms, we see it's, you know, around less than 60 kilos, generally speaking, per hectare. And again, according to National Farm Survey, these figures here are representative of 16,000 dairy farms, which would be more or less all dairy farms, whereas the beef and sheep farms represent around 60,000 farms. There are other farms that are probably using less fertilizer than this. And if we take the situation last year in 2023, we can see that figures are only coming available at half of dairy farms, and virtually all of beef farms use less than 150 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. So if we look at, say, using 150 kilos of nitrogen on clover, for example, that really isn't really hitting a wide audience. It's a very narrow audience, and I would say it lacks ambition. Really, we need to focus more on these lower input farmers and working towards lower fertilizer nitrogen use on those farms. So if we try to put numbers on that in terms of fertilizer use, we can see in terms of national land area, around 27% of the area is used by dairy farms, 65% by beef and sheep farms, and 8% by tillage farms. And then if we use the figures from the National Farm Survey, the fertilizer use, we come up with a figure that's very close to what we see on farms, or that we see nationally in terms of national fertilizer use. And it's no surprise that around 57% of fertilizer is used on dairy farms of nitrogen fertilizer. There's still a substantial proportion of national fertilizer use used on beef farms. And you could argue that reducing fertilizer on these beef farms is a much easier step to take than it is on dairy farms. And I suppose the point I'm trying to make, that if we are going to use fertilizer and nitrogen to cut emissions, it can't just be on dairy farms. It needs to be across the board. And I think there's economic benefits to go along with that. The other thing to consider is looking at 2024 is the nitrate regulations. Current stocking rate for this year with a middle band cows along the lines we have in Solihull is 2.39 cows per hectare. we're fairly restricted in nitrogen fertilizer use. And then there's nitrogen fertilizer, or there's the fertilizer register that's going to regulate the use. And we looked at this in Solid a couple of years ago. We said, well, there's no point in us using fertilizer nitrogen anymore, which is why we've more or less put it out. And we don't intend to use any nitrogen fertilizer this year, because carrying this kind of stocking rate is no challenge with the type of clover swards that we have at the moment. And then there's the question about the future of the derogation. And when I'm talking to people that know about these things, the impression I get, or the message coming back, is that the derogation is really under a question. And I think that's a pity, because if we take, as I said, we can easily carry a stocking rate of 2.39 cows per hectare with no nitrogen fertilizer. If we have to cut stocking rates further than that, say if we had to go less than 2 cows per hectare, the question is, what would we do with the additional grass? Because you have two options. If you were forced to cut stocking rates any further, you either put cow numbers on the farm, or you increase the farm area by taking on more land. And that raises the question, is that the best way to use our land resources? And should we not be considering land-sparing options for making that land available for other purposes, such as carbon offsets and for biodiversity? Like, we have a system that can work very well at around 2.4, 2.5 cows per hectare with no nitrogen fertilizer. Cutting it makes it less efficient. So if we consider that option, then extensive production will work with lower stock density. It will give us lower emissions per hectare. It will also lower the output from the farm, and also lower exports. And it gives us a lower capacity to generate wealth, and it will give us higher emissions per unit of product. If we consider the alternative, which is this idea of sustainable intensification, carbon offsetting, and space for nature, you know, farms, increasingly fragmented farms, are less efficient. There is an efficiency that goes with a certain stocking rate, a certain intensity of production. And I think this is a better option, making other land available for other purposes, as I said, which can be used for offsetting. And David Stiles in the University of Galway has been looking at this question in terms of modeling it and looking at options for the future. And he's a PhD student as part of this project, Daniel Hinn in the University of Limerick, who's recently transferred to the University of Galway, will make a presentation on this question on the 26th of April as part of this series. But to go back to our question, the last thing I'm going to talk about now is the question of adoption of clover on farms. And this shows the distribution of farms that we have involved in the project. And I suppose this partly came from a presentation I made on this series, I think it was 3 years ago. I think to Sinead Devaney asked the question, clover system works fine down in Solihull. How would it work up in the west of Ireland? So we'd been setting up a group down in the south. Well, William Burchell was setting it up down around the south of the country, below the line here that I'm showing with the mouse. And at around that time, we got in touch, or John McCabe got in touch with us, that he was setting up a group in conjunction with Arriva up in the northwest. So we have this, and that's something that we were hoping to achieve, to get a wide geographical distribution of farms. And this shows the distribution. We've a good number of farmers up in the west, and even up in Donegal. The third person involved in is Emma Buckley's, who's pulling together the data, and she's going to write up her PhD thesis using some of this data. And really, it's looking at the herbage milk production on these farms, carbon and ammonia footprints, which is work in progress, and also looking at how transitioning to a clover-based system will affect their economic performance. So in terms of the results I'd present, we've 35 farms in total, and we're gathering the data and putting the data together. And for 2022, we've data on 24 farms, 23, we've 28 farms. And these farms are gradually converting their farms over to clover-based grassland. So all of these farms have different options. All of the farms, except one, we've one organic farm, have the high nitrogen system on their farm in 2022. using 215 kilos of nitrogen per hectare. And then it was up to the farmers how they transitioned. Some, the most popular choice was this spring nitrogen. 16 farmers have tried it with 60 kilos of nitrogen fertilizer going in. Another option that some farmers were going for was spring nitrogen with a half rate in the summer. 14 farmers with 160 kilos of nitrogen per hectare being used in that case. And then the zero nitrogen system, which is five farmers along with the organic farmer, with an average nitrogen fertilizer input of 7 kilos per hectare, because there's always some nitrogen gets into the system. Then in 23, we had 28 farms, 26 using high nitrogen. One of those farms had transitioned completely away from high nitrogen, either to spring nitrogen or to zero nitrogen, using an average of 204 kilos across the 26 farms. Very similar figures for the spring nitrogen, 20 farms using 58 kilos, effectively a bag of urea per acre, bag of protected urea. Spring nitrogen then with the half rate, we see a reduction in numbers as farmers either switched over to spring nitrogen only or to zero nitrogen. We see 10 farmers doing it in 2023. Now, we've done a detailed analysis of variance of the average production on these farms, but averaged over 2 years, we see that there's no difference in average production on these farms, which is very reassuring from my point of view, because it more or less replicates out on farms what we're seeing in Solihull over a good number of years now. In terms of the overall picture on the farms, comparing 22 with 23, we see a reduction in fertilizer use as the farms are transitioning, and we don't want a quick transition. We want a slow and steady progress towards lower fertilizer use and greater use of clover on these farms. So fertilizer nitrogen went from 170 down to 139, which is more or less a 20% reduction in emissions. Fertilizer nitrogen input to the high nitrogen paddocks stayed the same. There was a reduction of around 5%. And we saw no difference in herbage production over the 2 years. If anything, it increased slightly. So the question then is, is the transitioning process, or, and there's two kind of aspects to that. One is putting red clover silage in on the outblock. And the alternative then is to focus on the grazing platform. And some farmers prefer to focus on this option first, with the idea that they put in red clover on the outblock, don't apply any nitrogen fertilizer to it. And then with the restrictions on fertilizer nitrogen and the fertilizer register, it gives them more flexibility to use nitrogen then on other parts of the farm. Technically, we know a lot more about converting pasture-based scenario or this kind of grazing situation than we knew about red clover. We've red clover in Solihull now for 6 years, and it's still relatively new crop in this country, but so far so good. We don't really know how long it will persist and that kind of thing, but our experience in Solihull has been positive so far. So in terms of what we recommend to the group, in terms of converting, we're recommending reseeding, and to reseed a manageable area of the farm each year, around 10% per year. And reseeding with clover really works best in the spring. An April reseed ideally, wouldn't be too keen on doing it any time later than the middle of May. We recommend 2 bags per acre of 10-10-20 after sowing, and then no more fertilizer nitrogen for the remainder of the year, or for the remainder of that crop as far as I'm concerned. And just putting a reliance then on biological nitrogen fixation. In that first year, of course, it can be very, it's a big risk for farmers to take this on. So what we recommend is the fertilizer that's saved on the reseeded area should be distributed across the remainder of the farm. And bearing in mind that we can get high levels of fixation from the reseeded sward, this gives us best, most efficient use of nitrogen fertilizer then across the farm. And we're very keen on making sure that post-emergence herbicides are applied for dock control, because you don't really see the problem until 3 or 4 years into the sward, like the dock problem develops. You don't really see the problem when you have your best opportunity to control it, which is immediately after reseeding. And getting post-emergence herbicide can be a problem, so it's really important that that's the case. We see fixation kicking off at around 5 or 6 weeks. We see the nodulation beginning on the seedlings, and these are white clover seedlings here. These are red clover seedlings, and we can get high rates of fixation in the establishment year. And really the best way to get a sward fixing nitrogen, being productive for the future, is it's very important not to put nitrogen on the reseeds. The type of mixtures that we use here, we've been using this one for the last 6 years, this one for 5. We're very happy with them. They're a bit unusual. We've got perennial ryegrass. We've got hybrid ryegrass in there, which gives us excellent spring growth. 2 kilos of red clover. And the red clover, as I said, in solid head under grazing, even under tight grazing, is persisting very well, along with 2 kilos of white clover. And a very similar type of mix here. Very different in appearance. This is a much more dense mixture. And I guess people would have their preferences. Both of these mixtures are commercially available this year. And that was a real problem for the last number of years. For the red clover outblock, this is what we're using, 4, 4, and 4, 4, perennial, 4, hybrid, 4, red clover, and then 2 kilos white clover. And again, this mixture is commercially available this year. If you can't get it and you're looking at alternative mixtures, really look at the red clover. It's important to get a red clover variety off the recommended list, and these are the ones that we'd recommend. We have good data on to recommend them. And also Ferga, which is the Chagas bred variety, which has come available there in recent years, and apparently it's available this year. And I just put the warning up there, be careful about using red clovers that are not on the recommended list. So then, just to tie this up, or in summary, we've seen in solid head we can maintain productivity with lower emissions and higher profits. That's something that we're looking at now out on farms. But so far it's going well, and so far so good. If we look at the zero nitrogen use, which is the fertilizer nitrogen use, which is the ultimate objective, that has the potential to lower national emissions by 10%. That's purely looking at it from the point of view of cutting fertilizer use. But there is another aspect to this, which is this idea of sustainable intensification. I suppose the thinking behind that is, if we've a suckler farmer, 20 hectare suckler farmer, stocked at one livestock unit per hectare, if you can hold the same stocking rate on half the farm on 10 hectares at 2 livestock units per hectare on a clover-based system, that frees up 10 hectares for other purposes. And that could even have a bigger impact on greenhouse gas emissions, which is another aspect of this project, which Dan Mulhin will deal with on the 26th of April. And the last thing then is just to acknowledge the funding from DAFM, and this project wouldn't have taken place without this funding. And I'd also like to acknowledge and to thank the farmers involved in the project, because we make fairly big demands on them in terms of data collection, and it's a big commitment on their part, and we're very grateful for that. So that's it, Pat.
Okay, if you just want to,
I'll stop sharing.
Stop sharing, and if I suppose one of the things I've talked to a number of farmers after they visited Solihull and seen what's going on, and I suppose the word I'd use for the reaction I get to most of them is that they've been inspired by what they've seen there. But in terms of practical difficulties for the farmers who have engaged and farmers who are thinking of moving along this path, what are the real practical difficulties that they have, or is most of us a kind of almost an attitudinal issue?
I look. The single biggest concern or obstacle is bloat, and the worry about bloat. And you know, we're very careful with our group to warn against that and to advise how to manage it. And like, we've got a lot of experience of it, and we'd have a good feel for when the risks are there, and we can put a message out in WhatsApp and that kind of thing. In terms of the other aspect, say the conversion process, the reseeding, not putting fertilizer nitrogen on the reseeds, like, that's been a very positive experience, you know. And you've some very intensive farmers in this group, and some fairly demanding farmers that, you know, wouldn't leave you off with a whole lot. But when you see them making the transition and it's working for them, like, that's more convincing than anything else that this is something that can work. And you know, this idea, some people might frown at that you put to save nitrogen on other parts of the farm, which means you could be going on with still fairly high rates of nitrogen on other parts of the farm. But like, when the farmers can see that these clover swards getting no nitrogen are producing just as much grass as the swards getting high nitrogen fertilizer input, you know, there's a lesson there, and that motivates them then to go to the next step. Most of them anyway, because in any group you have a variety of opinions.
Okay, just looking at a few of the other issues around it, I suppose one of the concerns with clover is the possibility of nitrate loss. Have you been doing anything just to monitor what's happening with nitrate loss from clover swards?
So,
and is there any concern in that space?
So in Solihull, we've been measuring nitrate leaching for 20 years, and our levels are very low. So we're not a good place to detect the differences. But clover system that we have, it is a high nitrogen system. We're getting high levels of production. We're growing 15 tons. We see 13 tons out in the farms with lower nitrogen than we're using in Solihull, and that's something to bear in mind. But it is a low nitrogen system. It is a high nitrogen system. It's just that nitrogen is coming from a different source. So the risks for our leaching are probably, you know, if we'd say ammonia, okay, we can get big reductions in ammonia. We can get big reductions in nitrous oxide. We're not going to see the same magnitude of reductions in terms of nitrate leaching. We're going to see some reductions because we're not using fertilizer, but, you know,
That in itself. I mean, I suppose that one of the fears is that it would increase it. So if you're saying that we're seeing reductions, that's a positive.
Well, I'd like to see the data because, you know, I think it's a pity in a way. Like, we've tried to measure it in Solihull. Like, our leaching levels are extremely low. Like, you're talking about down at 1 or 2 milligrams per liter of nitrate in, even with high nitrogen. So we can't detect it if it is there. I'd like to see good data on it, but I can't see any particular reason why. Like, when we look at nitrogen fertilizer, for example, and we've good data on this, we recover about 75% of the nitrogen that we recover in the crop. So there's 25% going somewhere. And that's what gives us the ammonia emissions, and that's what gives us the nitrous oxide emissions, and we presume that there's probably some leaching taking place. The clover fixed nitrogen is used an awful lot more efficiently. Yeah. So we can assume that there is some saving there in terms of nitrate leaching, but my guess is because most of nitrate leaching actually takes place through the animal as soon as she deposits urine, that's your main conduit. She's eating high nitrogen grass, whether it is highly fertilized grass clover or highly fertilized grass only or grass clover, you're still going to get the similar magnitude of leaching losses from that source.
I suppose just in terms of the research, in terms of output, you talked about output per of the grazing and grass growth and grass utilization. In terms of the output of milk or beef from the animals, are you seeing differences? I suppose some other experiments would have said that there are increases.
When you look at the literature on that, it's you see differences in some studies. You don't see differences in other studies. In general, we haven't seen differences. But I'd leave it at that because, at worst, it's the same, and at best, it's better. So there's no downside from that point of view.
Okay. Just remind people to use the question and answers. Owen, there's a good few questions coming in there if you want to just deal with some of them.
I suppose, James, there's one in there. Considering that beef and sheep farmers are using less than 65 kgs of artificial N, if they put clover into these swards, and we know it can fix an awful lot more, would it increase the surplus nitrogen, I suppose, in the system?
Well, I guess the question there is, and it's this old question of land use and how we use our land resources. You know, if we can increase productivity on beef farms using clover, it means that we can de-intensify or, you know, carry higher stocking rate. That means that we have more land available for other purposes. This is hypothetically speaking. Like, there's really good forestry payments there at the moment, for example. Like, it opens up alternative possibilities. And of course, with those forestry payments there, I presume, for carbon, paying for carbon offsetting. But like, if you take, as I was saying, a 20 hectare suckler farm, stocked at one livestock unit per hectare. If we double that stocking rate to 2 on 10 hectares, would free up another 10 hectares for other purposes. What's going to give us the biggest environmental impact? And I think the modeling would show that we're going to have a lower environmental impact across a range of different measures when we intensify rather than stay the same. assuming that the freed up land is used for purposes other than increasing agricultural production, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
No, there's a whole debate around that, and I'm certainly not able to talk about it. The options could be.
If that farmer didn't fundamentally want to change his farming system, could he go with a lower level of clover? Would that fit that mention? And
if you take the system we have in Solihull, that wouldn't really be appropriate for a lot of beef farms, a lot of the lower stock beef farms. But you'd look at different options there. You certainly wouldn't be talking about reseeding at the same rate that we're talking about at Solihull. Oversowing would be a bigger part of the picture. The grazing management really needs to be, would have the biggest impact on that. And I think particularly low winter covers and these type of aspects. But for me, like the questions people ask, spring grass, that's not an issue. Do you need nitrogen for silage production, which would probably be one of the big inputs on beef farms? We're growing all the silage we need without any nitrogen fertilizer. It's just a matter of having enough clover in the swards. I think it's an easy enough transition to make once there's good support there in terms of grazing management and other guidelines. And I don't think they're there at the moment for lower stock beef farms, or beef farms in general, I should say.
Yeah, so we might need a little bit of a different approach for those.
For sure, yeah.
Another question in there, how much P&K fertilizer has been applied to these zero-N farms? I suppose it's a very general question, but
I suppose from our point of view, in Solihull, we want to make sure that there's nothing else limiting us. And that's worked really well. Like, we've upped our pH based on some research in Johnston Castle. We were normally trying to work towards a target of 6.2, 6.3. Now we've everything between 6.5 and 7, and we intend to keep it there. We see really good production, and we haven't tested it systematically, but clearly there's a relationship. In terms of fertilizer K, then having it in high index tree, that clearly helps to promote clover. And I think the red clover in particular, like when I was in college, it's a long time ago now, but we were told the red clover doesn't persist. We've red clover in Solihull undergrazing where it shouldn't persist, persisting very well after 6 years. It's a tap-rooted species. Tap-rooted species have a higher requirement for K. It seems to fit that this works. And we've also some work Tom McCarthy has done looking at the impact of K on clover contents and that sort of thing. And that there is a relationship between the two. So I think high K helps to promote clover. There can be a cost in increasing soil K levels, but for Solihull, for us to maintain, and again, part of Tom McCarthy's PhD thesis, 20 kilos. If we look at our import output, our import and output, and the leaching losses that we're getting, and again, when I was in college, we were told that K doesn't leach. We now know that it does leach. It takes us 20 kilos or 16 units of K per 16 units of K per acre per year to keep us in balance. And that's not a big cost, relatively speaking.
Have you a figure for your P just to retain us in balance?
Well, you see, we've no P allowance in Solihull because of the history of the farm. The farm is owned by Tip Co-op. There was a lot of dairy sludge went out there in the 70s and the 80s. There's no sludge has gone on since the early 90s as part of a EPA license, but we've historically high P levels, and they're still very high.
Yeah. Perfect. Another question in on Conacre. So with the Conacre rental system we have here in Ireland, have you any ideas on how to manage this for transition to clover?
Well, Conacre is like, that's where you're taking it on for 1 year.
Yeah.
That's not really a very attractive proposition.
Would it suit the red clover?
It could, and you could do it. But like by the time you're into April, by the time you get the reseeding, you're really only producing, say, from June onwards. It's not an attractive proposition.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a shift more towards long-term releases, but maybe I'm wrong about that. If it's a long-term lease, there's no issue.
I'd say the way that question is kind of phrased, it's probably more of a long-term situation, but it's only a yearly agreement, I'd say. So maybe the right
well,
put into that.
Yeah, you know.
Question in there on Scholar Tinia developing in Red Clover, and what your advice is, or what you're finding.
What's the question, sorry?
Diseases in Red Clover.
There is a risk, and there is a risk. Exactly how big that risk is, we don't know. And the background to this is, if you look at the situation, like white clover is indigenous to Ireland, red clover is indigenous. We don't have any, we have diseases, but they're not damaging diseases of white clover. The same way as we can have rust in perennial ryegrass, for example, but it's generally not a widespread problem. There are, the stim mealworm is probably the biggest risk with red clover. And that really emerged when it was grown in conjunction with, you know, red clover traditionally was often grown in conjunction with tillage crops like potatoes, for example, which also carries this nematode, and other crops like beans and peas and that kind of thing. And there is a risk with that in those circumstances. And I think what really alerted me to it was in Denmark. So clover was very popular, red clover in particular, in Northern Europe, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, UK, in the 60s. The nitrogen fertilizer really took off. The use of nitrogen fertilizer really took off and displaced the clover on farms. And there's no doubt about that. During the 70s and the 80s, then the nitrates directive came into play in the early 90s and started in Denmark. And they were restricted in terms of stocking rates. And around 20% of their dairy farms went organic, went back to using clover, white clover, red clover, in the early, during the mid-90s, we say. And by the mid-2000s, they had serious problems with stim mealworm. Now, that's something that we have to be alert and aware of, which you have to take as well. We've 90% permanent grassland in this country, or in excess of 90%. They've only 14% in Denmark. Their systems are much more based on arable-type rotations. So, how big a risk is it for Ireland? We don't know, but we need to keep an eye on it. And the recommendation there is to allow a disease break between your red clover crops of around 4 years. But and that should be kind of practiced as a precaution.
What do you see fitting into that? So if a farmer is used to his red clover silage, very happy with it, what does he put that into for 4 years?
The way we're looking at it is, for example, if you had a 25-acre outblock, just take that as your starting. You put in your red clover mix along the lines I showed there with hybrid ryegrass, perennial ryegrass, 4 kilos of red clover, 2 kilos of white clover. Get very heavy crops of silage off that for the first 3, 4, 5 years, as long as it lasts. Over time, the hybrid ryegrass will die out, the red clover will die out. And the evidence for that is clear enough. How quickly it'll die out, it's dying out slower than we would have anticipated. But eventually you'll end up with a white clover perennial ryegrass ward, because as the red clover and the hybrid ryegrass dies out, the perennial and the white clover will fill in, and you can always oversow. If you use it predominantly for silage in the early years, you could switch over to using it more for grazing, maybe one cut of silage for grazing in the later years. And if the red clover is more or less gone out of the crop at the end of 10 years, that would be more or less a disease break. And we don't know how well that'll work, but...
So as the sward transitions to a grass white clover, then that's...
Yeah, the white clover doesn't carry the stim mealworm, so we don't, you know, if you allow that break without having to actually cultivate or anything else, the alternative then, of course, is it's probably not that very common nowadays, but to on some farms, you would have the option of growing red clover, maybe putting in maize or barley in between.
Yeah.
You know, that's still practiced in some parts of the country.
Another question in there for you, James. Will there be a certain amount of greenhouse gas emissions from highly productive red clover crops if the quantity of N being fixed is not fully required to grow the crop? So will there be a surplus?
No. No, like Owen presented the data last week. We don't get greenhouse gas emissions from nitrogen fixation. And with regards to the uptake, all of that nitrogen is taken up. Like if you said to me, a red clover crop, or it's a cut and carry situation, right? So you have red clover in an outblock. You're taking, we'll say for argument's sake, five cuts off it, 2-0 grazings, 3 silage cuts. You're taking all of that nitrogen away with the crop. There's very little left to be leached. And if you take the red clover, the hybrid ryegrass, that is huge capacity to take up nitrogen. There won't be any nitrogen left lying around in this situation. All of that goes into the silage pit. It's fed to the cows, goes in the slurry tank. The big risk then, of course, is when you're putting that slurry back out. That's when your nitrogen is available to be lost by leaching or by the other sources. And if that's managed well with a low emission slurry spreading, putting it on under good conditions, I would say red clover is a pretty low risk crop in terms of losses. And of course, look, it's also a relatively expensive crop compared to grazing on the platform. So, you know.
Yeah.
But I would say it's a low risk crop.
A couple of questions in relation to biodiversity, and has there been any assessment of the impact on biodiversity of a shift to a lot more clover? Are there positives there? And I suppose one other, looking at if there's more regular cultivation, are there issues for loss of carbon? So I suppose two related issues.
Yeah, so the first one is the whole biodiversity question, and I think there is a project. I'm aware of one project, I think, in UCC looking at this question. I think Saudi's Technological University are also interested in this question. I have no doubt, like you walk through a field of clover in the summer, it's alive with bees. You know, there'll be bees bouncing off it. You'd often see cows going through the swards as well. Something you wouldn't see on grass only, but birds flying over them because as the cows disturb the sward, you have all these insects rising up off it, and the birds, the swallows are swooping down to get them. So, anecdotally, in my experience, I'd say yes, there's probably positives. It's yet to be assessed, to my knowledge. I don't know. The second question then, we've been looking at this as well, and it's a big question. And it's a question of, we know when we reseed in solid head, we have substantial losses of carbon. We also have substantial mineralization of nitrogen. So we know that there's, and people often ask the question, well, that nitrogen, are you not recovering it by the crop? And the problem with it is most of that nitrogen is actually lost in the 6 to 8 weeks it takes the crop to establish. It's gone out of the system. We also lose a lot of carbon. The thing about it then is you reseed the crop and you start to regain carbon. Again, it's part of Owen Cashman's PhD to try to figure this out. When we look at our carbon levels now, and we have a 20-year data set in solid head, going back to 2001, it's even longer than 20 years. We're not seeing any great evidence of any loss of carbon. Okay, so we lose a lot of carbon during reseeding, a lot of carbon, but we gain that back then over the next 10 years or so. So we reckon if we're reseeding on a 10-year basis, we can maintain our we've got more or less carbon neutral reseeding.
Okay, a question in terms of the potential role of sulfur. And again, I suppose in solid head, you're a heavyish soil, so sulfur mightn't be as big an issue, but on other soils, particularly lighter soils.
Yeah, the options you have there, the simplest option is to use sulfate of potash in the spring instead of muriate of potash, which would be cheaper. In a lot of cases, you'd have to order it in. The other option then, if you have a P allowance, is to use single superphosphate rather than the more common triple superphosphate, which is 16% P. That one doesn't contain sulfur. The single one does, which is the 8% P. And the reason for that is it's in the manufacturing process. It uses sulfuric acid on bones. So if you can get single superphosphate, that's an option. Simplest option, relatively expensive option, I suppose, is to use sulfate of potash.
And what level of preparation in terms of working on soil fertility have the farms that are taking part in the trial and are working with you, what have they done in terms of making sure that their soil fertility is at an appropriate level?
I think that's a good question, Pat. I think they're fairly typical. dairy farmers in terms of, you know, they have a range of soil fertility. Like, other than advice, we've encouraged them to increase their lime use. If you're saving money on nitrogen fertilizer, don't save it on K in particular. We strongly encourage them to get their K in the sales up. But again, it's a bit like the choices the farmers make in terms of what approach to take to clover. It's really up. We're leaving that up to themselves. We just, like, we encourage, say, putting on lime during reseeding. Like, our focus has been around the whole question of reseeding, putting in the right mixtures. Because when we looked at some of the mixtures being used early on in this project, I wouldn't have been happy with them. You know, there's some, when you see the, you realize that there's a lot of relatively poor mixtures available out there in the market, and getting good mixtures is part of it. Putting on lime during reseeding to get the pH up and working it in that way, because that's the approach we take. In soil ahead, most of our liming takes place as part of the reseeding process. We don't really have to do much liming outside of that. And then to put on the K regularly, and that's something we focus on, particularly on the red clover.
A question there in relation to the, I suppose, the ability to stitch in on an ongoing basis, and how well that maintains the levels of clover versus, I suppose, periodic full reseeding.
Yeah, and I think that's the question again. If we're talking to dairy farmers, if we're talking to beef farmers, if we're talking to beef farmer, relatively, we say less intensive. I'd say oversowing is probably, you could maintain your clover fine when you're not under that same pressure for grass. Tis kind of getting your management right around oversowing is the key, and that's the key to that is tight grazing after oversowing. If we take the situation on dairy farms, like, we see reseeding as being important. We also see oversowing as being part of that equation, and I think the mixtures that we're looking at there now with the hybrids in it, that actually helps oversowing. It makes it easier to achieve a successful outcome. I think the problem in recent years, we seem to be getting these drier spells during the summer, and it's actually making oversowing riskier than it was, or maybe, you know, but it seemed to me to be an awful lot less riskier when 10, 15 years ago. But like, if you take the last four or five years, we've had these dry spells during the summer. So if you put in, if you oversow, say, April, early May, you get these dry spells, you know, that really knocks back your success rate.
Just a question in relation to the methane. Is there any difference in methane emissions from a clover sward than there is from a traditional?
That's a good question. I think there's some evidence to say that there is. There's an awful lot more evidence to say that there isn't.
Okay.
I'd like to say that there was
more work to be done.
More work to be done. I wouldn't be betting the house on that one.
Yeah.
Just a question in there, James. Most farmers are putting slurry back onto this red clover crop. How much slurry, or is slurry enough to feed that crop?
Well, yeah. So if you put on, say, 3,000 gallons of slurry for first cut red clover silage, like, that would meet your requirements more or less. And like, that's good practice. The logistics of it, you know, so the more slurry you can use, red clover has a high requirement for K. Let's face it, if we harvest red clover, put it in the silage pit, as I said, feed it to cows, a lot of the nutrients that the red clover needs are clearly in that slurry, because it has a high requirement for K. Cows remove only 1% of the K, 99% is recycled, and it's a good source of P. Insofar as possible, it's good practice to recycle slurry onto red clover ground as far as possible. The problem with it is it's often far away from the farmyard. There's often a cost with it. In our experience in Solihull, we wouldn't have enough slurry to fully fertilize the crop, depending on how else we use the slurry. But ideally, you put slurry onto your red clover silage ground as far as possible.
You said that there's no real challenge in managing zero nitrogen at a stocking rate of 2.39. Is there any issue with in terms of early grass when before the clover has really kicked in, or is there enough within the system there to drive the grass?
Okay, so for years we've been running this clover system with nitrogen in the spring. And a lot of the literature would say that that's what was required, and it seemed to make sense. We started running the zero nitrogen system. We had no idea how that was going to turn out. We saw it as a risk, and we ran it. We had the other system running in parallel with that. 5 years, we got no difference in spring production. And on that basis, then we said, right, we're getting no advantage. And that's why we're going with zero nitrogen across the whole farm this year. So we made the transition quarter of the farm first, then a half of the farm. And because we're seeing no benefit, and because I think carrying a stocking rate of 2.39 is no great problem. So we've been looking at this question also in terms of winter covers. So we've been carrying high winter covers and low winter covers now for the last number of years, because we know that a low winter cover really promotes the clover. In the following year, we get higher rates of fixation. And the big question then is the whole question of, can you get cows out to grass early, and how does that impact on your feed budgets during the spring? The real problem that we've had in 3 of the last 4 years is getting cows out to grass because of the weather. Like, it's really, like this year, again, it's a bloody nightmare. Like, but anyway.
Okay, I think we've believe it or not, we've just spent an hour talking about clover really fascinating work. Delighted that with both yourself and Owen last week, and as I say, in April now we've another session with yourselves looking at more at emissions from the system. Thank you very much, James. Very clear, and very clear answering of a wide variety of questions. Next week we'll be joined by Dr. Jenny Deacon from a senior catchment scientist with the EPA, looking at water quality, agricultural challenges and opportunities. And I suppose in the context of the focus now on water quality, it's a really timely presentation. So I hope you can join us for that. Just to thank James and Owen for their assistance, and Mary for her assistance in operating the webinar this morning. And we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to the podcast version of the Chagask Signpost series, the weekly webinar that promotes and examines sustainability in Irish farming. Don't forget to join us live every Friday morning for our latest webinar. For more, visit chagask.ie. And you can also rate, review, and subscribe to the Signpost series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Mark Gibson, and thanks for listening.